public apology at Tor headquarters, Iger was still dogged by journalists in search of skeletons from his past, none more determined than Mark Seal. In a two-part exposé in Vanity Fair titled The Temptation of Tiger Woods, Seal not only named names and spared none of the sordid details, but his reporting was also accompanied by risque photographs of Tiger's paramours. The worst part was that it seemed like Woods would never escape his past. Shortly after he got out of treatment, Tiger was confronted by one of his longtime neighbors, a 22-year-old college student who was home on spring break. She was distraught and anxious. Approximately a year earlier, in the spring of 2009, Tiger had taken her to his office about a mile from his home and had sex with her. She was looking for closure. Woods had known the young woman since she was 14. Her family lived in Isleworth, and her father, a successful Orlando businessman, had long admired Tiger. The one-time sexual encounter changed all that, causing heartache within the family, which fulminated anger and disdain toward Tiger. Initially enamored by the attention from the world's most famous athlete, the 21-year-old nonetheless felt guilty immediately after the encounter. The crib in Tiger's office was a painful reminder that Elin had just had a baby, so when Tiger reportedly sent this young neighbor racy texts in hopes of hooking up again, she ignored him. Then, when reports surfaced of Tiger's multiple affairs with other women, the woman felt used. "I just wanted to dig a big hole, crawl in, and die," she reportedly told a friend. She was more direct with Tiger. "I feel extremely violated by what you did to me," she told him. Tiger said he was sorry, but he suddenly faced a much harder situation. What, if anything, should he say about the matter to Elin? During treatment, Tiger had admitted to an overwhelming number of affairs with women he'd met around the world, but he hadn't told Elin about the girl next door. It was painful enough, for him and for his wife, to talk about affairs that involved porn stars, lingerie models, party girls, high-priced escorts, and pancake house waitresses. But they both recognized that it was a vital step on the long and tortured path to reconciliation. Tiger realized that his prospects of remaining married to Elin were tenuous at best. The only factor that weighed in his favor was Elin's desire to raise the children in an intact family. The children remained her priority, and her desire to do what was best for them was the driving force behind her effort to reconcile with Tiger. Any mention of his dalliance with a girl in the neighborhood would surely push Elin past the point of no return. From Tiger's perspective, after everything else he had dumped on Elin, telling her about the neighborhood girl seemed like pouring salt on an open wound. His wife's heart was already broken. What good would be served by adding to her misery? Whether motivated by selfish reasons, noble ones, or some combination of the two, Woods decided not to say anything to Elin. It was a decision fraught with danger and trepidation. For his entire career, Tiger had remained aloof on the PGA Tour, an almost mystical presence, distancing himself from players, fans, and the golf press. The time off from the sport changed his perspective and helped him realize how much he missed what he had always taken for granted. He also missed the competition. In mid-February 2010, he started hitting balls again. Then, in early March, he resumed working on his game with Hank Haney. Being on the range with Haney felt like old times. At that point, it was an easy decision. Forget the hiatus. He was returning to the PGA Tour. On March 16, 2010, Tiger issued a statement announcing that he was playing in the Masters the following month. "The Masters is where I won my first major, and I view this tournament with great respect," he said. "After a long and necessary time away from the game, I feel like I'm ready to start my season at Augusta." Hank Haney was surprised by the announcement and immediately thought Tiger was coming back way too soon. They had practiced together for only a week prior to Woods deciding to play in the Masters. Tiger was still spraying the ball all over the place. His game was a long way from being tournament ready. Besides being rusty, he looked lost and helpless on the golf course, like a man weighted down with the worries of the world. In Haney's mind, Tiger was setting himself up for failure. Augusta, after all, was the ultimate stage, and the spotlight on him would be brighter than ever. Sean McManus, the president of CBS News and CBS Sports, had predicted that Tiger's return to professional golf after the scandal would be the single biggest media event in the past 10 to 15 years outside of Barack Obama's inauguration. But Tiger's mind was made up. Nobody understood what it was like to be in his shoes. His life was in ruins, his messy past complicating and dictating his future. The one surefire place where he could establish some normalcy and do something that he felt good about was inside the ropes. even at the risk of alienating Elon, who wanted him to take a much longer hiatus from the game. There, over the course of 4 days and 72 holes, the rules would be different. In golf, the past is the last hole, the present is the current shot you face, and the future is the next one after that. Eager to get back to his comfort zone, Tiger summoned Steve Williams to Isleworth. It was time to get ready to go to Augusta. When Williams arrived at Tiger's home on April 3rd, he had a lot to get off his chest. After the scandal broke, Williams had repeatedly asked Team Tiger to release a statement clearing him of any involvement. Instead, he got the silent treatment. Then one mistress, cashing in on her 5 minutes of fame, insisted she had met both Williams and Tiger in Las Vegas, creating the inference that Williams had known about Tiger's adultery and covered it up. This unsubstantiated rumor spun itself into news in Williams' native New Zealand and soon splashed around the world. In rehab, Woods had finally communicated with Williams in the form of an email, apologizing for his actions. Later, he called Williams' wife, Kirsty, in an effort to smooth things over at home, but it was too little, too late. Kirsty had long considered Elon one of her best friends, and she wasn't persuaded by Tiger's words. In the meantime, doubts lingered about how much Steve knew. The bottom line was that Tiger's infidelity had damaged Williams' reputation in New Zealand and strained his marriage. Tiger was well aware that he had disappointed Williams. He also knew that it was on him to clear the air with his longtime caddy. But when Williams entered his home, Tiger was preoccupied. After a less than enthusiastic greeting, Tiger said they would talk later. In the meantime, he insisted he had to run out. This didn't sit well with Williams. He had a long list of grievances that he wanted to air, and he'd been assured by Steinberg that Tiger would have a face-to-face conversation with him once he got to his house. Frustrated, Williams was in a foul mood hours later when he and Haney joined Tiger for a practice round at Isleworth. "I don't even know why we're going to Augusta," Williams told Haney. "He can't make the cut hitting like this. It's horrible." Haney didn't disagree, but he also realized that Tiger's mind was made up. So, on the 18th fairway, he pleaded with Tiger to at least modify his swing path, sacrificing some distance off the tee in hopes of minimizing the degree to which his shots were going offline. "Tiger," he told him, "you have no chance the way you're swinging." Tiger finally made peace with Williams the next day on the way to the airport. Behind the wheel and wearing a pair of wraparound shades, Tiger never took his eyes off the road as Williams vented, telling Woods that his actions had put him and his family in a difficult position and that he was going to have to earn back his respect. It was pretty clear that Williams didn't feel appreciated after all his years of loyalty and service. Going forward, Williams said he wanted three things from Tiger: some verbal communication of appreciation, a pay raise, and an apology. The request for a salary increase bugged Woods, but he considered Williams a great friend, someone who had remained loyal to him through a very rough patch. Plus, he needed Steve back on the bag, and he didn't want any more friction between them. While Tiger mended fences with Williams, he had more pressing matters to worry about. The National Enquirer had found out about his affair with the college student at Isleworth. One of the girl's friends had talked to the tabloid, which was planning to break the story during the Masters. At the same time, Woods had to gear up for his first press conference since the crash. He was scheduled to take questions from the press at Augusta, and he was dreading it. Writers from around the world would be in attendance, and they weren't coming to ask him about golf. Basketball fans had embraced Kobe Bryant when he led the Lakers to an NBA championship after being accused of rape. Football fans had welcomed back Michael Vick when he turned in the best season of his career after serving 21 months in federal prison for his role in a dogfighting ring. Mark Steinberg believed that golf fans would forgive and forget Tiger's indiscretions too. The key, he told Tiger, was to perform well. The discussion about Bryant and Vick took place inside Tiger's rental home in Augusta, where Woods huddled with Steinberg to prepare for his press conference. Tiger fielded hypothetical questions and worked on his responses. Then, at 2 p.m. on the Monday before the start of the Masters, he entered the jam-packed media center at Augusta National and took a seat beside Craig Heatley, the chairman of the Masters Media Committee. "Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon, and a very warm welcome to you all," Heatley began. "I would also like to welcome Tiger Woods, our four-time Masters champion. Tiger, we are delighted to have you here with us." Going in, Tiger didn't know what to expect, but as he looked around, he suddenly felt at home. He knew the room like the back of his hand. So many of the faces were familiar. In therapy, he had learned a new phrase. Are you open? Tiger faced the throng of reporters and decided to be more open than he'd ever been with them. What I've done over the past years has been just terrible to my family, Tiger said. And the fact that I won golf tournaments, I think, is irrelevant. It's the pain and the damage that I've caused, you know, my wife, my mom, my wife's family, my kids going forward are going to have to, I'm going to have to explain all of this to them. This was better theater than golf or anything else on television in the middle of the day on a Monday. The networks cut into their regularly scheduled programs to carry the press conference live. It also aired live on the Fox News Channel, CNN, ESPN, and the variety of other cable stations and was streamed live around the world. With no prepared statement or notes, Tiger spoke from the heart, then took a barrage of questions about sensitive personal matters that would have been unthinkable to bring up before the scandal, performance-enhancing drugs, his relationship with the recently arrested Dr. Anthony Galea, Vicodin, Ambien, the state of his marriage, the police report detailing his car crash, his affairs, and the nature of his inpatient treatment. Woods refused to say the words sex addiction, and he politely declined to answer one question. What was he in treatment for? That's personal, thank you, he said. But he dealt with everything else head on, stating the following. He had never used performance-enhancing drugs, and he had only received PRP treatment from Dr. Galea. He had been contacted by federal authorities who were conducting a criminal investigation into Galea, and he was cooperating fully. He used Vicodin and Ambien, but he had not undergone treatment for addiction to either one. Rehab was brutal. His treatment was ongoing. Elon would not be attending the Masters, and he was doing everything possible to hold on to his family. What's been the most difficult thing for you to deal with? A reporter asked toward the end. Having to look at myself in a light that I never wanted to look at myself in, Tiger said. He pledged to tone down his angry outbursts when things didn't go his way on the course and to show more appreciation to fans. I need to be a better man, he said. This was Tiger 2.0. Uncharacteristically forthcoming, contrite, remorseful, the greatest athlete in the world had never looked so vulnerable, so human. Steinberg, Haney, and Williams couldn't help wondering how all this would affect Tiger's play. Intimidation, the steely glare, the cold demeanor, the machine-like approach had always been one of his best weapons. Would the reformed Tiger still have his competitive edge? Woods was more worried about how he would be received by the fans. Would they give him dirty looks, heckle him, or just gawk at him? Large crowds gathered to watch him play a practice round, following him from hole to hole, cheering him on and offering words of encouragement. The warm reception seemed to influence his play. Haney saw a noticeable uptick in the quality of Tiger's swing and his focus. Even Williams felt the positive energy. The fans were clearly behind Tiger. For the first time in a long time, he was smiling. Augusta felt like a refuge. Or so it seemed. After serving as the president and CEO of the Atlanta Committee for the 1996 Olympic Games, Billy Payne was named chairman of Augusta National Golf Club in 2006. One of his duties was to deliver an annual address on the eve of the Masters. It was a long-standing tradition, affording the head of America's most prestigious golf club to weigh in on the state of the game. But when Payne faced the golf writers on the day before the start of the 2010 Masters, he went off script and publicly scolded Tiger. He forgot in the process to remember that with fame and fortune comes responsibility, not invisibility, Payne said. It's not simply the degree of his conduct that is so egregious here. It is the fact that he disappointed all of us and, more important, our kids and our grandkids. Our hero did not live up to the expectations of the role model we saw for our children. It was one thing for pundits, newspaper columnists, and talk show hosts to pontificate about Tiger's misdeeds. That sort of thing happened so routinely that Tiger was practically numb to it. But to have the head of Augusta publicly chastise the number one player in the world on the eve of the most prestigious tournament on the PGA Tour was stunning. Payne spoke for the entire membership at Augusta, and he didn't hesitate to lecture Woods about his future. Is there a way forward? He said. I hope yes. I think yes. But certainly his future will never again be measured only by his performance against par, but measured by the sincerity of his efforts to change. I hope now he realizes that every kid he passes on the course wants his swing, but would settle for his smile. Payne had never previously commented on a golfer's behavior off the course, nor had his predecessor. It simply wasn't done. Normally, no one outside of the golf press paid much attention to the chairman's State of the Union address, but word of Payne's rebuke of Tiger instantly became a national story. Even the foreign press covered it. Tiger heard about Payne's comments while he was on the course, asked what he thought of Payne's insistence that he had disappointed everyone. Tiger took it in stride. "I disappointed myself," he said, leaving it at that. It hurt to hear that he had let children down and had failed to live up to expectations. Tiger didn't exactly need to be reminded, but even in private, he didn't feel like talking about it. "Man, how about Billy Payne?" Haney said on the car ride back to the house. "Yeah," Tiger said. That same evening, the following headline appeared on the National Enquirer's website. "Tiger Woods' sex romp with neighbor's young daughter." Shockingly, the website teased, "Tiger's sexual advances started in his car, only yards from where the golfer's devoted wife, Elin, was home, ending with a two-hour sex session on the couch in Tiger's private office. To see exclusive pictures of Tiger's young beauty, run, don't walk to get the new Enquirer before it sells out. Plus, shocking XXX details of his tawdry texts you won't find anywhere else." Like wildfire, the story went viral. Deadspin and the Huffington Post soon posted photos of Tiger's neighbor, and the Daily News and New York Post ran scandalous headlines. "Tiger bedded neighbor's 21-year-old daughter." For Elin, this appeared to be the tipping point. Around the time that news of Tiger's affair with the neighbor became public, she came to the conclusion that ending the marriage was better for the children than staying together without trust or love. She informed Tiger in no uncertain terms that their union was over. She wanted a divorce. Earl Woods used to tell his son that no man he ever faced would be mentally stronger than he was. He made sure of it, using some techniques that were not designed for a boy. Insulting him, motherfucker. Breaking him down, you little piece of shit. Pushing him to the edge, little nigger. In an attempt to toughen up his son, Earl treated him like a soldier in boot camp. But he was right about the end result. No golfer in the history of the PGA Tour matched the sheer willpower of Tiger Woods. Never was that more apparent than at the start of the opening round of the Masters on April 8th. A sea of humanity jammed the area surrounding the first tee. Patrons packed the grounds all the way back to the clubhouse. Inside, Tiger waited. The crowds had been nice to him in the practice rounds, but what would they think of him now? Suddenly, the door opened and Tiger emerged. Anxious but determined, he looked straight ahead and walked through a human tunnel of people who were close enough to touch him. The sound of clapping and cheers rippled from the clubhouse to the tee and down the fairway. "Tiger! Welcome back! We're with you!" Instead of blocking out the crowd, as he'd done his whole career, he smiled widely and nodded as he worked to keep his emotions in check. After months of being beaten up and beating himself up, he was at a place where he was accepted, among people who loved him for his talent. Then the crowd went dead silent as Tiger stood over his ball, preparing to take his first competitive swing in 144 days. Everyone, the writers, the other golfers, the television executives at CBS, and the other networks that broadcast golf, Phil Knight and the folks at Nike, the millions watching from home, and the thousands of fans hovering around him, was wondering the same thing. After such a precipitous fall from grace, can Tiger Woods still generate the magic? The silence was broken by the whipping sound of his driver and the sonic boom of his club head colliding with the ball. His ball soared straight and true, finally dropping down in the center of the fairway. It was a perfect shot that landed a cascade of cheers. He was back. Pleased, Tiger handed his club to Williams, and the two of them started down the fairway, propelled by the applause of the gallery. Overhead, a low-flying plane pulled a banner that read, "Tiger, did you mean Buddhism?" Even Buddhism, apparently, was fair game for mocking. But Woods could take the heat. He always could, as long as he was competing. As he hammered tee shots and sank putts through his opening round, Nike aired a jarring new commercial that featured Tiger somberly staring into the camera as if facing his father. Like a voice from beyond the grave, Earl speaks to him. "Tiger, I am more prone to be more inquisitive, to promote discussion. I want to find out what your thinking was. I want to find out what your feelings are. And did you learn anything?" The camera zoomed in on Tiger's eyes as the screen faded to black and the Nike swoosh appeared. For a man who craved privacy, Woods' sins were on full display, and his road to redemption would be trudged under the weight of public spectacle. "My regret will last a lifetime," Tiger later wrote. Yet amid all the swirl, Tiger shot a scintillating 68 on the first day, the lowest he had ever shot in the opening round of the Masters. He followed that up with a 70 in round two, leaving him just two shots behind the leader heading into the weekend. Through the first two rounds, he had smiled more at fans, hugged fellow golfers, and slapped the hand of his caddy more than in his previous 16 Masters tournaments combined. Williams welcomed Tiger's sunny disposition, but as he walked with Woods and Steinberg from the media center after the second round, he listened as Steinberg told Tiger that if he wanted to win, he had to stop being a nice guy and go back to the old Tiger. "I couldn't believe my ears," Williams later recalled. After all that Tiger had been through and the fact that he had made a public commitment to be a less snarling and aggressive Tiger, his main advisor was telling him the opposite. It was a turning point for Williams. He had been looking at the Masters as a good proving ground for Woods, a chance to demonstrate that he could be more tolerant, more appreciative, and less hostile. Suddenly, it felt like Tiger was being encouraged to scrap that. "Right then," Williams later wrote, "something inside me changed. A brick in the foundation of my relationship with Tiger had been pried loose." 24 hours later, Haney had an eerie premonition. "This will be the last time I ever work for Tiger Woods." The feeling came after Woods shot 70 again on Saturday, leaving him just three shots behind Phil Mickelson and four shots behind the leader, Lee Westwood. Astonishingly, after everything that had happened, with one round to go, Tiger was well within striking distance. He was right near the top of the leaderboard and in position to win his fifth Masters, yet he was fuming as he made his way to the practice range afterward. "I hit it like shit," he complained. On the contrary, Tiger had hit 15 of 18 greens on Saturday. He was playing superbly, but when Haney tried to boost him up, Tiger lashed out. The bottom line was that he had lost ground to Mickelson and Westwood, and Tiger blamed his predicament on his swing, which came across as him being pissed at Haney. The next day, Tiger showed up for the final round in a foul mood. His marriage was imploding, the tabloids and late-night comedians were pillorying him again, and fucking Mickelson was playing like he didn't have a care in the world. During warm-ups, Haney watched in silence as Tiger hit one low shot after another. He looked defeated. Finally, Haney stepped in. "You just have to get the ball up in the air," Haney told him. It was a familiar phrase between them, one that Haney had used for years whenever he wanted Tiger to open his club face to increase the trajectory upon impact. Woods had always responded affirmatively to the instruction. But this time, he looked at Haney and said, "What do you mean by that?" Then he resumed hitting low. It was as if he wasn't even trying. In that instant, something snapped inside Haney. The job no longer seemed worth it. Emotionally, he felt exhausted. Steinberg had told him more than once that Tiger considered Hank one of his best friends, but it didn't feel that way. Even after treatment, Woods didn't seem capable of reciprocating the graciousness that Haney was extending to him. As Tiger hit some final putts and started toward the first tee, Haney stepped to him. "You know what we talked about. Do that, and you'll be all right." Tiger nodded. "Good luck," Haney said. That would be the last thing Tiger ever heard from Haney on a golf course as his coach. Tiger eagled two holes during the final round, but Mickelson parred his first seven holes and pulled away from the field to win his third Masters. Tiger finished five shots back, tied for fourth. "Good job," Williams told him as they exited the 18th green to cheers of the gallery. "Good job." It was more than a good job. Only three players in the world had played better. None of them was trying to concentrate while the world crashed down around him. Williams was truly impressed, but Tiger had his life to get back to. He was in no mood to talk to anyone. He wasn't going to congratulate Phil. He wasn't going to thank people. He didn't have anything to say to Haney. Elon wasn't around. Steinberg's phone rang. It was Haney. "Mark, I'm finished," he told him. "I've had enough." "Hank, you can't do this," Steinberg said. "You can't do this to him. This is the toughest time of his life." Haney just listened. "You understand him," Steinberg pleaded. "He needs you. Whatever you do, don't abandon him now." Chapter 31. Separation. Tiger had spent 6 years with Hank Haney. During that period, from March 2004 to April 2010, he played in 93 PGA tournaments and won 31 times, including six majors. It was a remarkable run, during which Tiger won 33% of the time. By comparison, in a little over 7 years under Butch Harmon, Tiger had won nearly 27% of the time, taking 34 of the 127 PGA tournaments he entered, including eight majors. Woods and Harmon had spent more years together, resulting in more majors, but Woods and Haney had had a success rate that was unparalleled in the annals of golf. During that period, Tiger had come to trust Haney more than almost anyone else in his life outside of his family and Mark Steinberg. But the meltdown of his marriage and the disintegration of his reputation had a lot of unintended collateral damage. Haney was among the casualties. Shortly after the 2010 Masters and his conversation with Steinberg, Haney reluctantly agreed to try to stick it out with Woods. Taking Steinberg's plea to heart, Haney took the time to write a candid 5-page email to Tiger, proposing a plan for going forward. He copied Steinberg on the email. Given that Haney had just threatened to quit, he figured his long missive would draw a thoughtful response from Tiger. It didn't. Tiger never responded. After the Masters, Woods had bigger priorities than Haney's feelings. He was dealing with divorce lawyers, financial advisors, and questions about custody. On top of everything else, another woman had come forward. This one was claiming that Tiger was the father of her child. Needless to say, working his way through Haney's 5-page email wasn't on top of Tiger's to-do list. It wasn't until 2 weeks later, on the eve of the Quail Hollow Championship in Charlotte, that Tiger finally got around to calling Haney. He never mentioned the email, launching instead into the allegations about him being the father of another woman's child. Insisting that her timeline was off, Tiger said the claim couldn't be true. As usual, conversation was all about Woods and never got around to what was on Haney's mind. This had been the case throughout their relationship, but in this instance, it irritated Haney more than ever. At a time when Haney really needed Tiger to recognize his concerns about their partnership, he didn't. Without Haney around, Tiger played poorly in Charlotte, shooting a 79 on Friday, his highest score on the tour since 2002. He ended up missing the cut. A week later, Woods withdrew in the final round of the Players' Championship, complaining of neck pain. Once again, Haney wasn't there, and once again, Tiger was off. "Hey, Tiger," a young kid yelled as Woods headed toward the clubhouse. "Say so long to that number one ranking. Kiss it goodbye." Whatever magic Tiger had mustered for the Masters had quickly vanished. A month into his comeback, his swing was off, and he was distracted, impatient, and unable to make the clutch shots and critical putts that had long defined his game. Suddenly, he no longer looked like a superhero on the golf course. He looked beatable. Other players sensed it, and so did the fans. Meanwhile, he left his swing coach hanging. No dialogue, no calls, nothing. Fed up, Haney was determined not to be pushed aside the way Butch Harmon had been years earlier. "You're not blowing me off," he thought. "Fuck you." On the morning after Tiger pulled out of the Players' Championship, Haney wrote a statement explaining why he was quitting as Tiger's coach. He sent it to Jim Gray at Golf Channel and asked him to hold it for a few hours. Then he texted Tiger saying they needed to talk. "I can't talk today," Tiger texted back. "I'm with my kids." Despite the fact that he and Elin were proceeding toward a divorce, Tiger was spending as much time with his children as possible. In one respect, he was making up for lost time, but on a deeper level, the guilt he felt when he had missed Charlie's birthday during treatment served as a constant reminder that he no longer wanted to put anything, not even his career, ahead of his children. Oblivious to the fact that Haney was quitting, Tiger was surprised when he got a second text from him. "If anybody should understand the value of friends at this point in their life, it should be you," Haney wrote. "I feel like I've been a great friend to you. I don't think I've gotten that in return." Haney had always been ultra-sensitive to criticism about Tiger's swing. In this instance, Woods thought Haney was once again overreacting to things that commentators had said about his game during the last tournament. He had no sense that Haney's frustration went much deeper than that. "Maybe it's time that we just take a little break," Tiger texted. Without consulting his agent or his wife or anyone else, Haney replied with a message that was intended to cut the cord for good. "Tiger, I appreciate everything you did for me, the incredible opportunity I had to work with you," he said. "I can't tell you how grateful I am for the opportunity, but it's time for you to find another coach." Still, Tiger wasn't hearing him. "Thanks, Hank," Tiger texted, "but we're still going to work together. No, we're not, Haney said. It's finished. Done. Over. I'm no longer your coach. Seconds later, Tiger texted, we'll talk in the morning. That afternoon, Woods did a telephone press conference in which he reiterated that Haney was still his coach and that they had a lot of work to do. On the verge of losing his family and isolated from so many of his friends, Tiger seemed unable to come to grips with the fact that Haney was leaving him too. But by the end of that day, he had to face reality when Golf Channel read Haney's statement on the air. I have informed Tiger Woods this evening that I will no longer be his coach, he said. Just so there is no confusion, I would like to make clear that this is my decision. What followed was a classic illustration of the adage that breaking up is hard to do. First, Steinberg called Haney and told him that Tiger would be releasing his own statement that claimed their parting was a joint decision. Angry, Haney called the move bullshit and threatened to go public and call Tiger's statement a lie if he issued it. Haney's stance prompted Steinberg to modify Tiger's statement to say, Hank Haney and I have agreed that he will no longer be my coach. Right after it was issued, Tiger called Haney and thanked him for being a great coach and a great friend. You know, Tiger told him, we're still going to work together. Haney was baffled. Tiger, if you ever want me to watch you or help you with an opinion, as a friend, I'll be happy to do it. But we're not going to work together. I'm never going to be your coach again. We're still going to work together, Tiger said. Haney chuckled. No, we're not, he replied. Days later, Haney was interviewed on Golf Channel by Jim Gray, who asked him if he had ever known of Tiger taking performance-enhancing drugs. Haney said he believed that Tiger never took PEDs. The only thing I knew about was his issue with sex addiction, Haney said. Tiger wasn't pleased. Right after the interview, he shot Haney a text. Thanks for telling everyone that I was in sex addiction treatment. Steinberg was more outspoken. Fuming, he telephoned Haney. How could you do that? He yelled. How could you say that? How can he raise any money? This will kill his foundation. I didn't mean to hurt him or to cause him any problems. I apologize if I did, Haney said. You better not be doing any more interviews, Steinberg threatened. Mark, you don't control me anymore. I'm going to talk to who I want to talk to. For nearly 15 years, Tiger relied on Peter Mott and his boutique law firm in Southport, Connecticut, to oversee his complex estate planning and provide legal advice on his personal and business empire. It was scarcely an investment decision or property acquisition or significant financial transaction that Tiger executed without the advice of Mott and his partners. One of the best decisions Tiger ever made was to listen to John Merchant back in 1996 when he advised him to retain Mott's firm. Now it fell to Mott to guide Tiger through the most important transaction of his life, his divorce from Elin. By 2010, Tiger had earned well over $1 billion through golf and endorsement deals. His net worth was estimated to be in the range of $750 million. He owned homes and real estate in different parts of the world, some of which were jointly owned by Elin, along with other personal property. Since Florida law required an equitable division of property or assets, there was a lot to sort out. But Tiger had no interest in a contested divorce. Both he and Elin were unified in their desire to do what was best for the children. And that started with an amicable separation. So on a hot summer day, Woods and his lawyers met with Elin and her lawyers to negotiate the terms governing the custody of the children. Under the circumstances, it was a remarkably cordial session. Tiger made it clear that he wanted to meet the needs of Elin and the kids. After the session, he and Elin signed a marital settlement agreement over the 4th of July weekend. It included a parenting plan spelling out the shared custody of the children, as well as a stipulation entitling Elin to over $100 million. The plan was for Tiger to move into the 9,000-square-foot home that he and Elin had purchased on Jupiter Island, Florida for $40 million back in 2006. At the time of purchase, they had planned to eventually move the family from Isleworth to Jupiter, but now Elin and the children would look for a home of their own in nearby North Palm Beach. For Tiger, the divorce was devastating. The scope of what he had squandered was staggering. When he met Elin, her physical beauty was so breathtaking that people had trouble seeing past it. Fluent in two languages and exceptionally smart, she had career aspirations. But at 21, she put her ambitions aside, moved to the United States, and vowed to spend the rest of her life with Woods, for better or for worse. She channeled all her talents and energy into raising their children, and all the while, she never had eyes for anyone but Tiger, until Tiger broke her heart. Now the most beautiful woman he'd ever laid eyes on was no longer Mrs. Woods. When the court in Bay County, Florida, granted the final judgment of dissolution of marriage on August 23, 2010, Elin dropped her married name and had her maiden name restored, Elin Maria Pena Nordegren. For Elin, the divorce was liberating. In the weeks leading up to it, the stress was so bad that her hair started falling out, but she emerged from the ordeal stronger than ever. Although the family she had so badly wanted for her children was a thing of the past, she wasn't feeling sorry for herself. She was free from the stifling demands of the PGA Tour. She no longer had to live with the oppressive corporate structure that had coalesced around her husband over the years. And the hidden burdens of being Tiger's wife had been lifted. At 30, she was a single mother with dreams of her own. With her newfound freedom, she decided that the first thing she was going to do was set the record straight in terms of what she'd been through. In the entire time that Elin had been with Tiger, roughly 3 years as his girlfriend and almost 6 years as his wife, she had never granted an interview. The idea to do one after the divorce was something she had gotten from her lead attorney, Richard Cullen. In an arrangement brokered by Cullen and the general counsel for AOL Time Warner, Elin spent 19 hours over the course of numerous days talking to People magazine feature writer Sandra Sobiraj Westfall. The exclusive interviews took place at Elin's home and led to a cover story titled My Own Story. In it, Elin took the high ground, saying nothing negative about her ex-husband, but being open and honest about the pain and disappointment. "Forgiveness takes time," she said. "It's the last step of the grieving process. I'm going to be completely honest and tell you that I am working on it. I know I will have to come to forgiveness and acceptance of what has happened for me to go on and be happy in the future. And I know I will get there eventually." The world golf rankings are updated weekly, but between June 12, 2005 and October 30, 2010, the number one ranking never changed. Tiger occupied that spot for an unprecedented 281 consecutive weeks. That streak came to an end on October 31, 2010, when he slipped to number two, surpassed by Lee Westwood. By that point, Tiger hadn't won a PGA Tour event in well over a year, and the warm reception he had received from fans and fellow golfers 6 months earlier at Augusta seemed like ancient history. Fans were heckling him. Rivals no longer feared him. He had lost his wife. He had lost his coach. He had lost his swing, and he was about to lose his caddy. Not long after his split with Haney, Tiger asked Canadian-born Sean Foley to be his new swing coach. A certified golf geek, Foley was at the forefront of a new wave of instructors who embraced an emerging technology called TrackMan, a Doppler radar-like device that measures the collision of the ball and the club and tells you every single parameter from the path of the club to the trajectory and the spin of the ball. One day early on, as Foley used biomechanical terms like fascial chains and kinesthetic submodalities to explain his philosophy to Tiger, Steve Williams couldn't help thinking how bizarre everything he was saying sounded. For Williams, the arrival of Foley was the writing on the wall. Tiger wasn't the same, and neither was the friendship and the trust that had once existed between them. Together, Williams and Tiger had won 72 tournaments, including 13 majors. But ever since Tiger's return to the tour, the chemistry that Williams had once enjoyed with him was gone, which his choice of a new swing coach with a radical approach only made matters worse. In 2011, Tiger's swing and health consistently deteriorated. At the Masters, he injured his left Achilles tendon while hitting from an awkward stance. The injury forced him to withdraw from the Wells Fargo Championship a month later. Then, in mid-May, he withdrew from the Players' Championship after shooting an abysmal 42 on the front nine. He was diagnosed with an MCL sprain in his left knee to go along with the Achilles injury. 9 days before the U.S. Open at Congressional Country Club, Tiger announced he was pulling out of the tournament due to injuries. Within hours of withdrawing, he got a call from Williams, who explained that Adam Scott needed a caddy for the Open and had inquired about Steve's availability. Williams told Tiger he wanted to do it. "No problem," Tiger told him. But after hanging up, Woods thought about it and changed his mind. Scott was an opponent, and he didn't like the idea of his caddy helping an adversary. So he had Steinberg send Williams a text questioning the request. Angry, Williams called Woods. He'd already given Scott his word that he would caddy for him. It was a one-time deal, and he wasn't going back on his word. Tiger relented, but he wasn't pleased. The rift between Woods and Williams emerged as Tiger was also on the outs with IMG. His longtime agency had decided in May that it was parting ways with Mark Steinberg, whose employment contract was up for renewal at the end of June. Conflicting reports were published, some claiming that Steinberg was fired for poor performance or for his singular devotion to Woods, while others indicated that the two sides were not able to come to terms on a new contract. But as far as Tiger was concerned, Steinberg had done a masterful job representing him since taking over as his agent in 1999. More specifically, no one had been more loyal to him during the infidelity scandal and its aftermath than Steinberg. So when Steinberg left IMG to join Excel Sports Management, Tiger announced on June 6, 2010, that he too was leaving IMG to join Excel. It was the same week that Williams told Woods he was going through with his decision to caddy for Adam Scott at the U.S. Open. Scott played poorly at the Open, missing the cut. 2 weeks later, however, when Scott learned that Tiger would also be sitting out the AT&T National, he again asked Williams to be on his bag. The AT&T was a tournament that Tiger hosted. Some of the proceeds went to benefit his foundation. For personal and professional reasons, he put his foot down, telling Williams that if he caddied for Scott, they were finished. "Then we're done," Williams told him. Williams had always been the rare person in Tiger's inner circle who always spoke his mind. He had never been intimidated by Tiger, and his patience with Woods had grown increasingly thin in the wake of the scandal. Without hesitation, he told Scott he would be on his back for the AT&T. After the final round, Williams agreed to meet with Tiger in a boardroom at Aronimink Golf Club just outside Philadelphia. Woods was leaning back in a chair with his feet up on the table, a favorite power move of his father's, when Williams walked in. Williams quickly determined that it was a waste of time to vent his anger. Why bother? Instead, he wished Tiger luck. Tiger did the same. Like so many of the meaningful relationships in his life, this one ended coldly. There was a firm handshake, but there was also a lot of pent-up frustration in both directions. Tiger believed that Williams had been bad-mouthing him behind his back, an absolute no-no for a caddy, and Williams felt like he'd been jerked around by Tiger. Williams declined to discuss his employment by Woods, citing a non-disclosure agreement. In late July, right after the British Open, Woods announced on his website that Williams would no longer be his caddy, saying it was time for a change. The next day, Williams issued a statement. After 13 years of loyal service, needless to say, this came as a shock. Given the circumstances of the past 18 months working through Tiger's scandal, a new coach and with it a major new swing change, and Tiger battling through injuries, I am very disappointed to end our very successful partnership at this time. Tiger had helped make Williams a rich man. Reportedly, Williams earned $12 million in 11-plus years of caddying for Tiger. Yet Williams would later write in his memoir that at times he felt like he was Tiger's slave, an incendiary comment that was more an indication of the rocky nature of their breakup than a reflection of reality. But in August 2011 at the Bridgestone Invitational, Tiger and Williams were adversaries. Back from injury, Tiger finished tied for 37th, while Adam Scott won the tournament by 4 strokes. It was the first win for Scott with Williams on his bag. Afterward, in a rush of excitement, Williams tweeted, "This is the greatest win of my career." The message to Tiger was clear. Stick it up your arse. 2 months later, Tiger hired 47-year-old veteran caddy Joe LaCava to take over his bag. A steadying presence, LaCava was a classic New Englander, tough and deeply loyal. But when Tiger looked around, he saw only one person still standing with him from his inner circle, Steinberg. It was becoming fashionable to say that Tiger had lost his edge, that the aura of invincibility that had surrounded him for his entire career was gone. In 2011, recurring injuries limited him to playing in just 9 tour events, and toward the end of the season, after finishing tied for 13th in the Fries.com Open, Tiger saw his world ranking fall all the way to 52. He knew there were not 51 golfers in the world who were better than he was. There wasn't one golfer who was better than he was. Steiny agreed. Tiger just needed to get healthy. Chapter 32. Only Human. Heading into 2012, Tiger had not won a PGA Tour event in well over 2 years. Since returning to the tour in April 2010, he had played in 27 tournaments without a victory. It didn't help that he was in the midst of overhauling his swing for the 4th time in his career, and on top of that, his new swing coach, Sean Foley, was suggesting radical changes that critics contended were sapping Woods of his innate feel for the game and contributing to a rash of injuries. Pain in his neck, back knee, and Achilles forced him to withdraw from numerous tournaments. But the overarching problem with Tiger's game was in his head. His killer instinct was gone. Tiger's mindset had always been what separated him from everyone else. Players flat out feared him. He had the biggest muscles, the fastest swing speed, the best overall game, the bodyguards, the toughest caddy, the biggest corporate backers, the shrewdest agent, the most money, the prettiest wife. It was all part of the outsize image that he leveraged to intimidate opponents. But the infidelity and cheating scandal and his very public divorce had wiped out that aura of invincibility. It was as if the spell he'd long held over his adversaries had finally been lifted. Suddenly, they looked at him differently. Everyone did. Tiger was still the most talented golfer to ever play the game, but he was also fallible, a human being with weaknesses and frailties. Thanks to therapy, Tiger had also begun to look at himself in a more realistic light. His parents had raised him to believe he was the chosen one and trained him to be a cold-blooded assassin. But fame had been thrust on him at a very early age, skewing his perspective and damaging him in ways that were impossible to predict, and that took years to manifest. In other words, the seeds of his self-destructive addictive habits were planted long before his marriage to Elin. It took treatment to get him to realize that certain aspects of his life had been a lie. While treatment helped him put things in perspective, it also left scars. Tiger looked back on his time in therapy as horrible, summing it up as the worst experience he'd ever been through. It was an ordeal that broke him down in ways that affected the mental aspects of his game, wreaking havoc on his self-confidence, and leaving him vulnerable in the eyes of those whom he had dominated for so many years. Treatment also taught Tiger something that changed his modus operandi when it came to women, that he could no longer randomly have sex with someone unless he genuinely felt something for that person. Otherwise, he would be putting himself in serious jeopardy. On an intellectual level, this was easy to understand, but on a practical level, Tiger was facing a monumental challenge. As the world's most celebrated athlete, he became accustomed to casual sex with lots of partners. "I ran straight through the boundaries that a married couple should live by," he said. "I thought I could get away with whatever I wanted to. I felt I had worked hard my entire life and deserved to enjoy all the temptations around me. I felt I was entitled. Thanks to money and fame, I didn't have to go far to find them." Suddenly, he was being advised to do two things that didn't come easy to him. Show restraint and pursue a meaningful, healthy relationship with a woman. It was a tall order. "There are some girls who are going to be after me even more now," he had confided to Hank Haney shortly after he completed the gratitude program, "especially the wild ones." His situation made for a lonely, treacherous, and at times impossible existence. Back when Tiger first started dating Elin, journalists described her as living a fairy tale life on account of winning over golf's most eligible and richest bachelor. But that narrative was wrong from the start. "People think it's like a Cinderella story for her, but Tiger is the one who got the catch," Mia Parnovic told Sports Illustrated back in 2004. "With the weird lifestyle he leads, he might never have met a nice girl. He's lucky he found Elin. I mean, can you imagine how empty his life was before she came along, just hitting golf balls all day long?" In hindsight, Parnovic's assessment seems prescient. 10 years after meeting Elin, Tiger had essentially reverted to hitting golf balls all day long, and the notion of establishing a new relationship with a so-called nice girl seemed like a pipe dream. Avoiding women altogether, it appeared, was the safest course. Golf, on the other hand, was the one thing that gave him a sense of purpose, a reason to get out of bed every day. He still thrived off the competition, which helped explain his determination to grind away at refining his swing and his drive to keep playing through pain. At the tail end of 2011, he felt like he was finally turning a corner when he finished the year by winning the annual tournament that helped benefit his foundation, the Chevron World Challenge at Sherwood Country Club. Although it wasn't an official PGA Tour event, the tournament provided him a much-needed victory, boosting his confidence heading into the 2012 season. Physically, he was feeling better, too. For the first time in a long time, things were looking up. Then he got hit with something he never saw coming. In January, Tiger heard that Hank Haney had written a book, The Big Miss, My Years Coaching Tiger Woods. It was due to come out right before the 2012 Masters. Hank wrote a book? Stunned, Tiger immediately questioned Haney's motives. Why didn't Hank mention this? Tiger wasn't the only one who was upset. Steinberg was furious. Airing private moments and conversations between a swing coach and a golfer violated an unspoken cardinal rule within the world of golf. It just wasn't done. Worse, Haney didn't give Tiger the courtesy of a heads-up. The blind side was proof of the bad blood that existed between Haney and the duo of Woods and Steinberg. I didn't inform them of anything, Haney later explained. I had nothing in my contract that said I couldn't write the book. Given Tiger's obsession with privacy and his penchant for requiring people who worked for him to sign confidentiality agreements, it was mystifying that Haney was free to write about things he had witnessed and heard during his extensive one-on-one time with Woods. Even his publisher had trouble believing that he wasn't under any legal restrictions. His editor at Crown repeatedly asked him to verify that he had not signed a non-disclosure agreement. Haney consistently assured them that he had never been asked to sign one. Steinberg screwed up, he said. Tiger and Steinberg viewed Haney's book as an act of betrayal. Of course, it paled in comparison to the betrayal of extramarital affairs and sophisticated attempts to cover them up. Nevertheless, Haney's book promised to wound Tiger, exposing a rift that might have been avoided if Tiger had been more demonstrative in showing gratitude. Simple gestures of appreciation and empathy would have gone a long way with Haney, but Tiger didn't do show and tell with his feelings. When he ended relationships with people, he forgot them. In Haney's case, almost 2 years had passed since they parted ways. In that entire time, Tiger never once called just to say hello or see how Haney was doing. The last words he spoke to Haney were, "I know we'll always be friends." To Haney, that was really code for, "Don't say anything." He decided to break the code. Adding insult to injury, Haney had chosen Jamie Diaz as his collaborator. No golf writer had known Tiger longer or understood him and his family better than Diaz. He had spent significant time in Tiger's family home, traveled abroad with Cultita, and been Tiger's choice to help him write his golf instruction book. As far as Woods was concerned, Diaz's involvement with Haney's book was one more betrayal. At the end of February, Golf Digest published the first excerpt from the book. It focused on Tiger's obsession with becoming a Navy SEAL in 2007. Claiming his military-style training exercises put his body at risk of injury. The claim sparked headlines and debate. Even the SEALs came under fire, facing questions about whether they had, in fact, allowed a civilian to train with them. "I can confirm in 2006 he fired weapons at one of our ranges," a SEAL spokesman told CNN. It's important to remember that at this point, the public was not aware of Tiger's military fixation. Haney was essentially outing him. With controversy brewing, Steinberg went after Haney, calling his approach armchair psychology. In a statement, Steinberg said, "Because of his father, it's no secret that Tiger has always had a high respect for the military, so for Haney to twist that admiration into something negative is disrespectful." Criticizing Haney's book before it was even on sale only fueled interest in it. During a press conference prior to the start of the Honda Classic at the end of February, Tiger was peppered with questions about the SEALs. One by one, he brushed the inquiries aside until Golf Channel contributor Alex Miceli pushed back, asking if Tiger actually considered joining the SEALs. "I've already talked about everything in the book," Tiger said tersely. "I've already commented on everything." "Then I must have missed you answering that question," Miceli said. "Well, I already commented on the book," Tiger snapped. "Is that in the book? Is that in the book?" Miceli said he hadn't seen the book. He only read the excerpt. "You're a beauty," Tiger said, using his go-to code word for asshole. "You know that?" It was the kind of cold put-down that Tiger was known for, but in a move that would have been unheard of before the crash, Miceli didn't back down. Saying that Steinberg's statement suggested the excerpt was erroneous, Miceli pressed to know whether what Haney had written was true. Furious, Tiger glared at him for 5 long seconds. "I don't know," he finally said, breaking the awkward silence. "Have a good day." Haney's book was an instant bestseller, shooting to number one on the New York Times list. The fact that someone from the inner circle had dared to write what he had seen and heard while in places such as Tiger's home caused a sensation. Journalists who covered the tour couldn't resist reading it. Players couldn't stop talking about it. Caddies and swing coaches were whispering. Haney had covered everything from Tiger's relationship with his wife to the way he treated people one-on-one. He even took some swipes at Steinberg. But Woods played through all the noise. On March 25th, 2012, he won the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill, his first PGA Tour victory since the BMW Championship back in September 2009. He followed that up with an abysmal performance at the Masters, and then was forced to miss a few tournaments due to pain. But in June and July, sandwiched between a poor showing at the U.S. Open, he won the Memorial and the AT&T. By early July 2012, Tiger had climbed back to the number two ranking in the world. Only Luke Donald was ahead of him. In the midst of what looked like a resurgence in his game, Tiger met 27-year-old Olympic skier Lindsey Vonn. A friend of Tiger's who worked at his foundation introduced them. Leery of women since undergoing sex addiction treatment, Tiger was immediately at ease around Vonn. Despite meeting countless women in his life, Tiger had almost certainly never met one who had as much in common with him as Vonn. Pushed by her father, she was on skis at age 2 and was skiing year-round by age 7. As a teen, she moved with her mom to Vail, Colorado to train and ski exclusively at the elite ski and snowboard club Vail. Her high school years were very non-traditional, taking classes online in order to accommodate her intense training schedule. Vonn did not attend dances, do sleepovers, or meet friends outside of the skiing world. By 16, she had started racing on the professional World Cup circuit. She went on to win a record 8 World Cup season titles in the downhill discipline and became the first American woman to win an Olympic gold medal in downhill skiing. Tiger greatly respected Vonn for her talent. He also admired her dedication. A typical day for Vonn consisted of 6 to 8 hours of training. She lived to ski. Yet, despite her dominance in her sport, Vonn struggled with her self-image. Growing up, she was self-conscious about her body, fearing that she stood out for the wrong reasons, too tall and too muscular. And while she was arguably the best female skier in the world, she never got comfortable with fame. The one place she felt totally confident was on a mountain where she was fearless. In many ways, Woods and Vonn were kindred spirits. For the first time, Tiger had encountered a woman who had the same sort of tunnel vision he did. Vonn's mentality enabled her to understand Woods in a way other women simply couldn't. He just wanted to win, she said, summing him up, and he wanted to be the greatest. It sounded simple, but Vonn knew from first-hand experience that Tiger's drive fueled his preoccupation with the conditioning of his body and the performance of his game. To others, Tiger appeared selfish. To Vonn, he looked familiar. Elite athletes, especially those who play individual sports, have to be self-centered. Tiger and Vonn had something else in common. They were both rebounding from broken marriages. A few months before meeting Tiger, Vonn and her husband, the first man she had ever seriously dated, initiated divorce proceedings. The divorce was messy and took more than a year to finalize. But in Tiger, she found someone to trust, someone to talk to, someone she felt safe with. Over the latter part of 2012, Tiger and Vonn quietly built a healthy friendship. By the time Vonn's divorce was official in early 2013, Tiger saw her as more than a friend. She had met Tiger's children and easily connected with them. Even Elin liked Vonn, particularly because of how much the children enjoyed being around her. For the first time since the crash, there was a woman in Tiger's life who cared about him. On February 5th, 2013, Tiger was at home and his television was tuned to the FIS Alpine World Ski Championships in Austria, where Vonn was competing in the Super Giant Slalom, or Super G race. A Super G course requires skiers to make turns past widely set gates while racing at speeds that are much higher than those reached in giant slaloms. On the women's side, Vonn was the top Super G racer in the world and was favored to win the competition. With his personal chef, his housekeeper, and his 5-year-old daughter Sam in the room, Woods watched Vonn fly down the course in Schladming at nail-biting speed, when suddenly Vonn's knee buckled and she went hurling over the tips of her skis, sprawling down the mountain in a horrific crash. Writhing in pain, Vonn screamed so loudly that her cries were heard on television. It was a scream Tiger feared that might haunt his daughter. He quickly asked his housekeeper to take Sam out of the room. Intimately familiar with excruciating knee pain, Tiger didn't need to watch replays of Vonn's crash to recognize that she was in really bad shape. Feeling helpless, he watched as medics airlifted her to a nearby hospital where doctors delivered a grim prognosis. Her anterior cruciate ligament and her medial collateral ligament were torn. She had also fractured the upper part of her tibia. It was hard to predict when Vonn would ski again. Determined to do all he could, Tiger dispatched his private plane to transport Vaughn back to Colorado for surgery. He also saw her during pre-surgery and assured her that everything was going to be okay. The hardest part, he knew, would be the post-surgery. "It's going to hurt," he told her. "It's just going to hurt. And you're going to put yourself in a different place, a different state of mind." Vaughn's accident was a pivotal event in their relationship. Shortly after the surgery, they decided to announce their relationship on Facebook.